If you listen to KCUR on the weekends, you already know Francis Lam. He hosts The Splendid Table, which plays on Sundays, and he talks to all kinds of people about cooking and eating and how both of these seemingly simple activities are woven into the fabric of our lives. Well, Francis Lam is here in Kansas City, so even though we might think we already know him, we're going to get to know him differently by turning the tables and asking him the questions. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And Francis Lam, it's a real pleasure to meet you.
It's great to have you. Listen to me. I'm already, it's great to have you here.
My nightmare. The Splendid.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. The Splendid Table is just one piece of your food career. You went to culinary school, and I understand that you actually fell into writing about food by some elaborate emails you were sending to friends.
It's true. I was I was in culinary school. This is back in 2002, and you know, I was not the youngest student in the class. You know, I was in a class with like 18-year-olds and, you know, who had just come out of high school and, you know, a few career changers who were probably in their 40s or 50s or whatever. But I was like 25 years old. I had, you know, been out working in the world for a while, and I just knew that I had a passion for food and for learning about food. And there was a part of me that thought, oh, maybe I would go to graduate school and do anthropology and study, you know, food ways and food traditions. And I can't even get that sentence out of my mouth now without wanting to fall asleep. So
yeah.
That probably was not a good path for me. But really, I also knew that whatever I wanted to do to study food would have to involve my hands, because for all my love of flavor and all my love of like deliciousness and all my love of that stuff, I also always felt that, you know what? The people who make food and the people who grow food are really the heroes. And especially back then, like now chef culture is so huge.
You don't find it heroic to just eat it?
Well, it depends who you are, I guess, and what you're eating. But yeah, no, I just feel like at the time, I just knew that if I was going to do anything with food, I would want to have knowledge of the work involved in it. And so I went to culinary school, and again, this is 02, so it was before there was blogs, or at least before blogs had gotten really popular.
Yeah, it was like live journal days.
Yeah, you know? And I just felt like I was having all these experiences and all these lessons I was learning. I just had to tell someone about them. So I started emailing friends and family about stuff I was learning. And, you know, oh my God, did you know that there are only three ways to fillet a fish? And if you learn the three ways to fillet a fish, you can fillet any fish in the ocean? Like, it was crazy to me. And you know, there was a moment I also remember one day after class. It was 10:30 at night. I was tired. I'm walking to the parking lot, and this guy I like barely knew was a pastry student, and he just got into his class. And he's like, "Hey, man, I just learned to fry donuts. Want some?" And he like opens this box of like 12 fresh donuts. I'm like, "Where am I right now? Like, this is amazing." So I wanted to tell these stories to friends and family. They got forwarded around, and randomly, about halfway through the program in early 2003, I got a phone call from an editor at a newspaper called the Financial Times. And it turns out an old friend of mine worked three desks down from this person and was saying, "Hey, you should check out my friend's emails. He's in culinary school right now and he's having a lot of fun." And the editor's like, "Oh, these are great. I want him to come write for us." And that's how I started. It was total and complete dumb luck.
Your grandfather from Hong Kong noticed and perhaps inadvertently encouraged your enthusiasm for food, I understand, at a really young age.
Yeah, I'm sure he would never, had he been still alive, he would never have told me to go to culinary school. He would have told me to stay away from that industry as much as he possibly could have. But he was someone who born and lived his whole life in China. Well, in mainland China, and then eventually in a very rural, very, very poor village, and literally walked out of his village in mainland China and eventually made his way to Hong Kong, which, you know, was a British colony. And in the latter half or maybe last third of his life or so, he actually made a fair bit of money and was pretty comfortable. And as I remember it, spent so much of that money. He had a huge family, like dozens of children. But by the time I knew him as his grandchild, I just remember him being someone who was so happy to spend his money feeding people the food that he never could have when he was younger, right? And that generosity and that passion. And like, you know, I come from a Chinese American family. I was born and raised here in the States. My parents were immigrants. So we had a lot of the traditional sort of Chinese mores. And, you know, one of them is like absolute respect for your elders. I say this as I was just texting my mom literally 10 minutes ago, apologizing to her for being incredibly disrespectful to her the other night at dinner. We got into like a political argument and I started was like, "You're crazy, mom, you're crazy." And I'm like, "Oh God, I just said that to my own mother." Anyway, yeah. But my grandfather, you know, being the patriarch of the family was, you know, he was the end all be all of authority, right? And I remember one night there was a dinner where I was at a table. There was a huge group of us, or actually two tables of our family at this restaurant. I insisted on sitting at the grown-up table. And
how old do you think you were at this time?
I like 7, 8, 9. You know, like I was a kid. Not like a baby, but definitely a kid.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sit with the grown-ups because I wanted to eat what they were eating. I didn't want to, like, you know, go have like just like whatever the kids table is having. And the whole steamed fish came out at one point at the end of the meal, and that was like always like the sort of star of a Chinese banquet or a Cantonese banquet, is the whole steamed fish. And I just reached my chopsticks right into the fish before anyone else.
You speared it.
I speared the fish from the river, and took the bite from the fish's cheek, which, you know, I mean, that is the that is the single best bite in the fish. Well, there are two of them. That is one of the two best bites in the fish. And because my grandfather's a table, that is by rights his. So everyone at the table was appalled. And they all stared at my parents, like, what kind of child are you raising? And I was like, uh-oh. And then my grandfather just laughed. And he said, well, this one really knows how to eat. And in that moment, not only did I get away with it, but I also felt like this was the emotional validation that I was always craving, you know? And I really think, I mean, I don't like feel like, oh, that changed my life. But definitely now, in retrospect, I think of that moment and I think about all the times where I felt, wow, like it. To me, it's one thing to love food. It's another thing to actually feel like this is like sort of the source of real
this
personal
is like
validation.
A calling.
Yeah.
You know, but as you tell this whole story, you're describing a person taking a bite of a piece of fish.
Yeah.
But when you think of everything that went into that story, the story of immigration, the story of changing finances in a person's life, mm-hmm, the story mm-hmm. of aging and how a person changes as they age, the story of different generations within one family.
Sure.
This is all coming together just in that bite of fish you took. And I wonder how you think that way of thinking about your own past maybe shapes what interests you when you talk to other people about food.
I mean, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And the way I've been really privileged and fortunate to be able to, you know, work on the Splendid Table. I've been the host for about 2.5 years now. Obviously, the show has had a very long history before that with the founding host, my predecessor, Lynn, who's wonderful. But I was a writer for many years. I wrote about food. And that has always been at the core of how I do my work around food in terms of, you know, my writing and being on the radio. You know, to me, I love cooking. I love the act of cooking. I love geeking out about flavors and combinations and techniques and all that stuff. And I love sharing that and I love teaching that. So that is definitely a big part of what I do. Like, I did go to culinary school, right? But for me, what's really interesting is when you start there and then go beyond there, when you go beyond what's on the table and you start to see what's around the table or what brought the people at that table together or what made this dish come to be. What were the historical factors that created this dish? Why is it that a Mexican taco al pastor looks a whole lot like a shawarma from the Middle East? And it's, oh, because Lebanese immigrants to Mexico brought the technique of, you know, cooking on a rotating spit. And, you know, that became a technique adopted by Mexicans and then made into, you know, their own form. Like, I'm fascinated by all that stuff. I'm fascinated by the fact that almost every dish you eat in a restaurant is the factor, you know, comes from cultures and people who have moved from one part of the world to another and brought their ideas with them. I'm fascinated by how much you can learn about a person when you sit down to sit down next to a stranger at a bar, and you start just having a conversation with them. If you ask at some point, you know, I mean, this is probably not the first thing you'd ask someone because it'd be weird. But if at some point in your conversation you'd ask them, oh, where they're from, and oh, do you eat that dish that I heard from that place? Did your mom or your dad make that for you? And next thing you know, they might start telling you about their whole life. You know, like, it's an incredible entry point into so many different conversations.
Well, that brings me to this thought about that you are in this pretty unique position of talking about food, preparing food, eating food all over the country. And I'm curious how you think that style of getting to know food regionally is maybe different from someone just searching online now that everyone's dinner plate is infinitely Instagrammable.
You know, it is a real question. And you know, I just had a wonderful interview a few days ago with a chef, Sean Brock, who's sort of known as a Southern chef. And his what's really turned into his life's work is bringing forth these traditions of Southern food that people don't really know about in a big picture way, where, you know, sort of breaking the stereotypes of Southern food as just being fried chicken and you know, greasy greens, and really talking about heritage ingredients and traditions that came from West Africa that, like, we really owe the enslaved Africans for, and all these things. And one of the things we talked about was not just, like, the regionalism of Southern food, but micro-regionalism. And he talked about the fact that, like, if you take the region that we consider the American South and you put it on a map, it's pretty much the same size as all of continental Europe, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't shock us to think, oh, there are 450 official types of cheese in France and every village has its own kind. And, you know, you cross the border into Italy and it's totally different. And we expect those kinds of regional variances there. And here in the United States, we don't necessarily think about our own regional variances as much. And part of it is we're a much younger country. Part of it is, you know, we're also a country that really tied together culturally a lot, are really tied together culturally in the modern age by national media and more and more so, like you said, by social media, that, like, you know, on my Instagram feed right now, I'll look at a picture from someone in Anchorage and I'll flick it, you know, half a second later, I'm looking at a picture from someone from Kansas City and a picture from someone in, like, Duluth. You know, it does seem like it all blends together. So we have this national blending together right now. But I think what's so exciting when you actually physically go to different corners of the country, and corners that you don't know and you've only heard about and you've only heard stereotypes about, and really start to talk to people in their home place and really, okay, maybe, like, I'm in Kansas City. True story. I did come and eat barbecue. It was my first meal yesterday. A little, I was like, is it too cliched? I'm like, I don't know. You're going to go to Rome and not see the Colosseum? Like, I'm going to eat barbecue in Kansas City.
You just made like 2,000 friends.
Like, what are you going to do? Like, if it were Chiefs game, we're on and go catch that too. But the fact of the matter is, like, I would love to then have the opportunity to go a little deeper than that, right? What else is wonderful here? What are local farmers growing here that I don't know about because they're not hitting the pages of glossy magazines, but are still important to the people here, important to the traditions and families of people here?
Have you found any answers to those questions yet?
Well, I've only
been
one night.
You've only been here a short time. But so you did eat barbecue yesterday, and I'm curious where you went, what you thought.
Well, I only had time for one meal, which I took in two different places. I went to Joe's, and I went to LC. And, I mean, very, very different vibes, very, very different styles, and loved it.
You loved it. That's the review.
Loved it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how about... part of what you are juggling in your life, in addition to food writing, a radio show, travel, is fatherhood. And mm-hmm. I'd like to hear about the role of fatherhood in your food journey, because we often talk about how parents or grandparents influence us, but our kids do too.
Totally. That's a great question. I think when we talk about how our grandparents, you know, it's sort of funny. I was also having a conversation yesterday with a friend of mine who's an amazing, amazing food writer, really, really smart thinker, named Helen Rosner. And we were talking about the fact that for all the years we've been in food media, for every magazine or every like website we ever worked for, there's pretty much been, I guess not, or at least for many years anyway, there's been like an unspoken or sometimes pretty spoken rule at almost every publication, no grandma stories. And by that we mean, you know, the beautiful personal essay about, I remember growing up at my grandmother's knee, tugging in her apron, seeing her hands as she made this thing, and now as an adult, I realize how much love went into that.
Can I just say something about this?
Yes.
I interview a lot of people about food too, and whenever anyone wants to relate to me, they say like, you know, when your grandmother was cooking for you, blah blah blah. My grandmother did not cook.
Yeah.
And I just nod. Yes.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's become such a cliche and such a stereotype. And the fact is, like, not all grandparents were great cooks. And anyway, the point is, we have this sort of nostalgia, though. And I think what that is a stand-in for nostalgia and this idea that, oh, the food of the past was more authentic and the food of the past was better. In a lot of ways,
it was.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, of course, it was. You know, I'm not going to argue against that. But there's this sort of, you know, gauzy sheen, this romanticization of it, this fetishization of it that we forget. Well, it also meant that that person was probably cooking 16 hours a day to make all three meals and had no time for anything else other than like, oh, also cleaning the house and doing the laundry. Like, it was not necessarily a great lifestyle. And then so sort of like the other piece of it, like you said, being a parent now. And so I have a young daughter. She's between the age of being, she's like an older toddler, I guess you would call her.
So like three-ish?
Yeah, you know, and, you know, a lot of my cooking life is now not just about cooking for her, but the kind of cooking that I do for me and my wife with her schedule being like the dominant factor in our lives, right? Like I get home from work at usually 7 o'clock. Just in time for bath time. That morning I prepared like dinner for her and put it in the fridge so my wife could like reheat it for her. Like she picks her up from school because she works closer to school, picks her up, she feeds her dinner. I get home in time to give her bath time, and then I'll usually do bedtime or we'll switch off bedtime, and then I'll go cook dinner for us. And at that time it's like 8 o'clock, 8:30. And like I'm not gonna be, you know, and we wanna eat. So I'm cooking a lot more stuff that's really quick. I'm doing a lot more, you know, prepping a lot of vegetables and cooking a big pot of rice and cooking a big pot of grains on the weekend so I have stuff to work with.
There has to be a strategy. There are deadlines.
Yeah. It's not cool guy, look at what I can do cooking.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, on one hand, you can be like, oh, it's just getting by. But on the other hand, it's also like, no, this is part of what being a parent is about in a good way.
It's real life.
Yeah, and in a way you can embrace, right? In a way that to me is not about, it's not just, oh, what am I missing now? Or, oh man, we can't go out to dinner if we want to. Like we used to be just have like a random date night on Tuesday because we felt like it, you know? Like, and it's, you know, instead of focusing on all the things you lose, it's what are the things that we can embrace about this life? What are the things that we can feel are, okay, we can nourish our bodies. We'll still do it in a tasty way. It's not going to be as elaborate, but it's also about like, how do we maintain the best of our ability given our work lives and all that stuff? And everyone has its own challenge and their how their life shakes out. But being as present and as good parents as we can be, and this is going to be part of it.
I really enjoyed a piece that you wrote for the New York Times where you took this deep dive into your son's love of peppers. Or I guess it was your daughter.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I have a son, so my mind just
popped
him right in that story.
Does your kid like peppers?
He does, yes.
Sweet
raw peppers, just like your daughter.
She loves them, well, until she decides that she no longer wants to look at them. And you're like, I just bought 3 pounds of these things. And she's like, Daddy, no peppers. I'm like, what?
They are a whimsical audience.
They are. Well, I mean, thank you for reading that piece. And it was about the fact that it was about exactly that. Like, she was super into raw red peppers. So, like, great. They're a healthy snack. I cut them for her. And I had, like, a couple pounds of them in the fridge. And one day she was just like, nope. No more. And they're just like wilting, getting sad. I had to figure out what to do with them. And so that is also part of it right now. It's like, that is part of, maybe the best way to put it in terms of like the mental change is we don't make all the decisions anymore. You know, like she has agency and now we have to deal with her agency and she doesn't like those peppers anymore. Okay, I'm not going to let them rot. So now I got to figure out something to do with them for us.
In that article, you write that the question at the heart of your signature approach to cooking is, and I quote, if I cook this a little and it's good, what happens when you cook the bejesus out of it? Can you explain that?
It really is. I don't know. I think it started when I started making ratatouille, which is, I think in its traditional state, is just a pretty simple vegetable stew, tomatoes, a very like deep summer stew.
I think eggplants are pretty crucial.
Yeah, eggplants, like summer squash and tomatoes and onions. And, you know, those are pretty much the key ingredients. It could be very light and fresh. Maybe it's a little bit of wine. And somehow through this long, convoluted story that involved a lot of like debate between these like macho cooks. And I was like, you people are crazy. I ended up cooking it in a way where I cooked the onions and garlic for a super long time, and they were like really caramelized. And then I added like red peppers that I pureed in a food processor until they were like liquid, cooked that in there until it was also caramelized. And then I did the same with tomatoes. And I made this incredibly, like just unbelievably, just wildly delicious, basically like savory tomato pepper jam. And then I like separately roasted the other vegetables and used that jam almost like as a condiment and toss it all together. And it's truly one of the best things, probably the best thing I know how to make, the most delicious thing I know how to make. And
please tell me this recipe is published somewhere.
It is. It's like one of the things that I've published in like three different places. So it's like all over the internet, like Francis Lamb Ratatouille will come up. The kicker is, I mean, the caveat is you kind of have to make it with really great summer produce, like the great summer tomatoes and all that stuff. So we're just a little beyond that now, depending on where you live. If you're in South Carolina, you can probably still do it. And the other thing is, it'll probably take you 6 hours to make because you just got to sit there and stir that jam and cook it for a super long time. And the first time I made it for my wife, she's like, oh, you made tomato paste. It comes in cans. I was like, just taste it before you speak. Don't Aww. Make me cry. I mean, she's hilarious. It's amazing. That totally inform this idea of, well, that worked out. What else can I just take and cook for a super long time? And as you cook, especially vegetables, you drive off all the water, you concentrate all the flavor, but you're also slowly changing the vegetables in the heat, and all the natural sugars will caramelize, and wild flavors come out of even like really boring, tame vegetables when you start to cook it for a super long time, because what also happens is the cell walls break and all of the juices and like micro oils and essences in there come out, and they really change in heat. So it's different than boiling them for a long time. It's different than roasting them for a long time, like pureeing things and cooking them and stirring them for a super long time so they don't burn on the bottom. Just totally changes things.
As a cookbook editor and someone who develops recipes, I am curious to know how you hope that a cookbook or recipe will fit into someone else's life. Because we've talked a lot about how these things all emerge from mm-hmm. your life, but how do you see this playing some part in a home cook's life in the kitchen, in their repertoire, even in their life beyond the kitchen?
Well, honestly, as a cookbook editor, like the part I really hope it plays in their life is that they decide to buy it. Keep us in business.
Real but, talk.
But like honestly, it really it could be any number of things. And honestly, the books I work on I'm always excited by, because I think usually they're multifaceted projects. And by that I mean I want all the books I work on to be delicious and cookable and like well just like, you know, our guides to making incredible food at home. But at the same time, I often work with authors who really have real stories to tell. either personal stories or stories about cultures that they're really familiar with, or stories about society, stories about our society, stories that will actually like make us scratch our heads and think a little bit harder about what we're doing and what our assumptions of our food. And so for a lot of my books, for example, one is, I have one coming out this fall. It's not my book, but an author I worked with named Toni Tipton Martin. She has a book called Jubilee coming out this fall that's based on her collection of African-American cookbooks. She has probably the world's biggest private collection of cookbooks written by African-Americans, going back to literally the very first one. And she's basically taken recipes out of each of these books and modernized them. So in one way, it's like a history of 200 years of Black cooking. But really what she's done too is shown us how incredibly diverse the story of Black cooking is. It's not the stereotypes of soul food and Southern food.
You are doing this event in Kansas City tonight. It is sold out, so I'm glad our listeners who don't have tickets got to meet you by listening to this conversation, but you will be featuring a handful of local food producers. Can you tell me a little bit about who you've got lined up and what you're really super excited about?
Yeah, we have really, really wonderful roster of guests we get. I'll get to talk with on stage and really get to dig in with. We have chefs Michael Smith, Linda Durr. We have Alex Pope from a local butcher shop. We have Chris Good, who runs a series of Ruby Jean's juice bars here in town. And we have the family behind the Bo Ling's restaurants.
Frances Lam, host of The Splendid Table, thank you so much and enjoy the rest of your time in Kansas City.
I'm having a blast already. Thanks for having me.
Tonight's sold-out event is at the 1900 building, and you can hear The Splendid Table on Sundays from 2 to 3 on this station. Up next, Bob Dylan fans from every generation are getting psyched for Sunday's show. Call 816-235-2888 with your story of falling in love with Bob Dylan. We'll be right back.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others. Let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay.
Bob Dylan is 78 years old. His first album came out in 1962. Here are a few things that hadn't happened yet back in 1962. Color television hadn't made it to Hawaii or Alaska. There were no seatbelt laws whatsoever. Segregation was still legal, and the Vietnam War had not yet ended. The Bob Dylan who will be performing at the Midland in Kansas City this Sunday is not the cherubic kid who appears on that first album cover from 1962, but some of his fans look a lot now like he did then, which is to say, Bob Dylan fandom is as youthful as ever. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we're talking to local fans about what keeps Bob Dylan eternally relevant. Call 816-235-2888 with your story of coming to Bob Dylan's music and his message on your own terms in your own time. 816-235-2888. I'm here in the studio with poet Iris Applequist and folk singer Casey Rausch, who are both highly influenced by Dylan in their own ways. Iris, hello.
Hi, Gina. Good morning.
Hi. Casey, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gina.
I want you each to just start by telling the story of when and how you got turned on to Bob Dylan. Iris.
Oh, man. I was, I think the very first time I ever heard a Bob Dylan song was in the movie Forrest Gump, when the character Jenny is on stage as a burlesque performer behind a guitar. And
oh, my gosh. That's adorable.
Yeah. My grandma took me to see that movie in the theater. Inappropriate. I was really little. But then as a teenager, my best friend in high school, Emily, her dad's record collection was sort of kind of petered down into her possession, as things do like that. And we just embarked on the middle class high school white kid career of like doing drugs and skipping school and listening to music.
And so the albums that were once her parents were still cool to you on site from the moment you encountered
them?
Yeah,
they were imbued with this mystical kind of power. Like, they had, like, Bob Dylan especially is this, like, pan character, like this archetypal bard who could probably impart secrets of of the ages to you, but in, just in a code that you have to decipher and work on.
How do you think that, oh, well, Casey, what about your story?
Well, kind of similar. My mother's record collection, which was a part of my life from as far back as I can remember. So I don't really remember a time that Bob Dylan wasn't a part of my life, but I remember the time when it's suddenly sparked my interest more, for going from hearing my family playing his songs, I come from a long line of music makers, to my sister starting to dig into those records and me hearing the music flow from her room going, hey, that's that song Uncle Terry plays, and then dive in deeper from there.
What were some of the first songs that really like sparked your interest?
Blowing in the Wind, Mr. Tambourine Man, those basic ones that, you know, are easy, simple 3-4 chord songs that pretty much any folk musician can play, and then moving on from there.
So how do you think that his influence found its way into your music?
Well, from just that, from those early songs of, you know, Bob Dylan's got this, I like to call it a simple complexity. Some of his songs are so simple that it makes you believe that you could sing something like that too, whether it's that particular song or whatever 3-chord song you wanted to play and make up, because this guy did it so simply. But then, of course, as you start diving into his collection of music and poetry, you understand, oh, this is really complex stuff also.
Okay, let's listen to some music. I want to play Blowin' in the Wind. We're going to listen to this now, and then we'll talk a little bit more about all the influences that Casey was just describing.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. And how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see the end?
Okay, so I wasn't going to do this, but can I tell you my story of getting into Bob Dylan?
Do it. Yeah.
My mom used to sing this song to me when I was a really little kid, like young enough that I can't even like form a coherent memory out of first hearing this song. But I have thought as an adult, what a weird choice of like a lullaby. But I will say, I still remember my own childhood visualization, like what I pictured in my head when I was hearing these lyrics, and the way I continued to turn them over and try to make sense of them over many, many years. And it that affects how profoundly I'm hit when I listen to this song, is just that there was a code that once I understood it, when I was learning history basically in school, once I really, really understood it, the message in it is so deep and so profound and so, yes, relevant. I mean, you can hear echoes of it in Black Lives Matter.
I think Bob Dylan helped teach a lot of us how to ask the questions that needed to be asked. And he did it so simply that sometimes you didn't even realize it was the lesson. And there it was. You know, how many times must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? These are important things we need to ask ourselves. And Bob Dylan just did it in this beautiful, poetic way.
Iris, how do you think his influence may have shaped or inspired you as a poet? We're friends. I've known your poetry and you for a long time. I hear his music in the rhythms of your writing, but also in the particular way you play with language?
And it has to do with what you were, you and Casey were just mentioning, like his music imparted these lessons about how to look at the world and how to understand my role in it, how to bring the hugeness of the world into distillable moments, and then also make the intricate privacy of your emotions.
Still keep a secret in his lyrics.
Yeah. And you can also project these really personal things and make them bigger than the world.
There is also a real bite to some of Dylan's lyrics. Something tender can suddenly take a sharp turn that leaves you stunned. You do that too.
And yes. Yes, I do. I do do that. I'm hard pressed to come up with a concrete example. I was combing through some things to try to find a concrete example of a Bob Dylan influence. And if you ever have the opportunity to comb through old writing from like 10 or 12 years ago, just avoid it.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
So will you share something that you think has his influence in it, whether it's what you would want to be writing and reading today or not, or no, it's too embarrassing.
I could do something. The dog was born with three legs, which is a lot better than one of his legs having been rent from his body in an accident or maiming. He learned to walk still, even run, even hunt. His life was just as busy as that of any dog with four legs. He once saw a dog with five legs, a stunted, lame leg that grown out of its chest, and he felt a feeling that for dogs is as close to pity as I can describe. After adolescence, he could forget that he was so obviously different from other dogs whose differences would require some investigation. He took several mates and begat many children, none of whom would share his defect. He had trouble with dances and swimming. He sometimes became coarse and irrational for seemingly no reason.
Mr. Jones the dog? what do you think has changed in the way you are influenced by Bob Dylan? You've talked about that you were looking through writing from 10 to 12 years ago, and that implies to me that the way you think about him and what matters to you about him maybe has changed since then.
Yeah, that's an astute observation, Gina. Great job. When I was drawing or trying to draw influence directly, it was a lot based on his more romantic escapades in song, where he's talking about his interpersonal relationships. And that's how I understood my life, is through my interpersonal relationships when I was younger. And as I've grown older, I'm more concerned with, politics and the way we organize ourselves in groups. And he has comments on that, many, many comments on that in his earlier folk music. And as I look at that and his role in the canon and in popular culture, while it's like extremely valuable, and there's lots of things in music and in popular culture we couldn't have now without Bob Dylan's influence, I still find that
is his influence less about him and more about the world?
I think his influence can't be more about the world than what it is. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Capitalizing on all the privilege and all the advantages that are granted him, knowingly, but also selfishly in certain respects. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
Casey, I'm curious from you why you think that while so many musicians and pop culture icons have their decade of fame if they're lucky, Dylan doesn't seem to go out of style.
I think Dylan has this way of just being authentically himself. At least I don't pretend to know him personally, but that's how I perceive him. We've seen him change throughout the decades, and he's gotten criticism for it. He's gotten support for it. He doesn't pay much attention to that. He just keeps moving forward wherever he is authentically. And and keeps redefining himself. And I think that is a really brave and freeing thing to do. I think so many of us, especially as artists, when you get into making music for a business or as a, you know, this thing that you're going to create for your life, you're encouraged by the music industry to find your brand and
stick to it.
And Dylan just smashes all that to pieces. And I think that he bravely shows all parts of himself, while so many of us get stuck in just, oh, I can only show this one side of myself. And we're all multifaceted.
I want to bring in another voice. Laura Tenshert is the host of a Bob Dylan radio show called Definitely Dylan, which is exactly what it sounds like. But the host is maybe not who you'd imagine. She's a young Londoner. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Dina. Hi, Iris. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Hello.
So what inspired you to obsess publicly over one artist, that artist being Bob Dylan?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, it was that I started this radio show in early 2018. And at the end of the 2017, I was kind of at a loose end. I had just dropped out of my PhD. And I was kind of looking for a new project that would be challenging and also fun. And I really liked the idea of starting a radio show. And Bob Dylan just seemed like such an obvious subject, because I've always been a Dylan geek. But I've also noticed that all of the books, or almost all of the books and articles and essays that have been written about Bob Dylan were written by men. And I just, over the years, found myself disagreeing with them quite often. And especially when it came to the subject of women in Dylan's songs.
Okay, and let's talk about that. Okay, you have a whole episode called Women and Dylan, and you deliberately put women first in that title. What's the prevailing thinking about what I'll say misogyny in Dylan's music, and then your take, because your take is a little different?
Yeah, so I think, as you rightly say, I deliberately called the episode Women and Dylan, because I think so many people have written something about Dylan and women and how Dylan supposedly sees women and so on. And my take on this is that this is a really nuanced conversation. And I think it's really important that it's a conversation that we're having that women are part of. And I think there's a real problem that most of the writing, most of the discussion surrounding Dylan so far has been led by men. And usually they, you know, there is a mention saying, oh, you know, this line is sexist. And then that's it. You know, they're saying, well, Dylan clearly is a chauvinist because he writes the song just like a woman. And I think it's never that easy, because this is not Dylan, the person speaking. This is art. And I think art should never be interpreted as, you know, telling us something about the person that wrote it necessarily. I think, in my opinion, it's just very important that we're having this conversation about a cultural figure like Dylan, who has influenced so many people, including women, and that we invite women into the conversation for, you know, what he is actually saying about gender.
Laura, just real quick, I want to play a song that lays some of this bare. The song people always play to talk about this is Just Like a Woman, but I'm not going to do that. I want to play another song from the same album, but one that's always struck me. Sooner or Later, One of Us Must Know. Can we listen to that real quick?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Treat you so bad. You shouldn't take it so personal. I didn't mean to make you so sad. You just happened to be there, that's all. Smile. I thought it was well understood that you'd be coming back in a little while. I didn't know that you were saying goodbye for good. Okay, Laura Tenshirt, I would like to say I could live the rest of my life without being told not to take something personally, but I also would relish the opportunity to hear this kind of confession from someone about the lack of regard for my feelings.
Yes.
Is this...
I think... Sorry.
Yeah, no, go on.
Well, I think, I mean, this is an example for, I don't know, one of those songs that are usually cited when people talk about like how Dilling was quite like sharp in his observations of relationships in the mid-60s. But also, you know, we have to remember, I mean, this is, you know, he was 25 when this came out. And I mean, I think what's interesting about an artist like Dylan is that we see his, like, over the years, we see him mature in his work as well. And that also, you know, is translated in the way that he talks about relationships. And again, you know, I'm not, I think we shouldn't take it personal in the sense that, you know, this was Dylan saying this to a specific woman, you know. He might just have been imagining a scenario and writing about it, you know.
Yeah, Laura Tenshirt, thank you so much for joining us from London.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Enjoy the rest of your evening. Laura is the host of Definitely Dylan. We'll get right back to this discussion with a local celebrity who you may not know is a Dylan fan. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Bob Dylan over the years. We've had some fans in the studio who are not first-generation fans, Iris Applequist and Casey Rausch. They grew up with his music on some level, but now we're branching out, and Mike Mahoney joins us. You probably know him as a news guy from KMBC. You may not know he's a huge Dylan fan. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. This has been a great discussion to listen to.
Tell me about your relationship with Dylan.
Well, it started when I was in junior high, and not with the chestnuts of Blowing in the Wind or Times Here Changing or that, but his albums Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited that had these complex pieces of poetry that he set to music that just stunned me. And the thing I want to tell folks here is, oh, I'm clearly the oldest person in the room here. Bob Dylan's music is ever-changing, and when people go to this show that is here in Kansas City on Sunday night, they're not going to hear Rolling Stone. They're not going to hear Blowing the Wind. They're not going to hear Times and Changing. They're going to hear reworked versions of songs that he has done. Dylan always regards one version of a song that's on the record as simply one version, and that his music lives. And the show that Kansas City will see on Sunday night has vastly reworked arrangements, sometimes brand new lyrics. I heard a show just last night from earlier in the tour. It's astonishing. It's very impressive. And I'm not just a Valentine kid for Bob Dylan. When he sucks, he does. He's bad. But this is a very strong show.
So there are some people who want to kind of preserve the young Bob Dylan for themselves, the young rebel. What is the side of him that you are hearing now and seeing now that you really appreciate?
That he's ever-changing. People say, I like Dylan in the 60s. I like Dylan in his 60s and his 70s. He has been writing and producing some of the most creative music of his entire career in the last 20 years. He is by no means an old rock and roll oldies act. He is a very vibrant poet and music composer right now, and his shows are alive.
You know, are you going to the show on Sunday?
You bet.
What are you going in for? Like, what is it, as someone who has been clearly following his career on a really sort of like incremental level over a long period of time, what's the thrill in that?
The thrill on this particular show is that there are new members in his band. He has a new drummer. He has a new lead guitar player. He is, as I said earlier, reworking some of the songs that have been on record. For instance, just to seg into this segment, you played the opening chords of Not Dark Yet.
Yeah.
Okay, he's covering that song in a radically different and stunning version in this tour. He's doing the old Chestnut Girl from the North Country, one of my favorite songs. Very, very differently. He's adding another song, very obscure, about Lenny Bruce. He is ever changing, and that is the charm of Bob Dylan.
Iris, Casey, are you all going to that show this Sunday?
I'm out of town, darn it.
I don't like going to concerts.
So Mike Mahoney will be our in-studio representative at the Midland this Sunday. Mike Mahoney of KMBC, thanks for being here and sharing your love.
My pleasure.
I'm
looking forward to this.
Dylan. Iris Appelquist and Casey Rausch, thank you, too.
Thanks for having us, Gina.
This conversation will be at kcur.org/centralstandard. In case you missed anything, we'll have it ready by the end of the day. Our chat with Frances Lam earlier in the hour will be here, too. If you are hanging out at home wishing you could be at that sold-out event tonight, just pull that audio up, and it'll be the next best thing. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll have a portrait session with local Renaissance woman Natasha Elscari. Today's show was produced by Noah Taborda with help from Aviva Okus and Haberman. Melody Rowell is our lead producer. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.